Using the I word in Egypt, insurgency, that is. Today, Wednesday, September 18th, this is The World. I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman. Egypt's crackdown on the Islamist opposition continues. Some observers worry the country could descend into civil war, with the Islamists as insurgents.
Suppose you lived in a country where you felt that the military had ousted your elected president. You know, would you join the resistance?
Also today, Australians traipse all the way to Chicago to protest a new McDonald's back in their hometown. And an immigrant actress from Argentina describes how people in New York react to her accent.
The moment you walk in the audition room, you see the faces when you have an accent. You see how they look at you.
We'll hear whether that's good or bad, plus looking for SpongeBob and finding him in Egypt.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run, at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. The war in Syria isn't the only ongoing crisis in the Middle East right now. Remember Egypt? Its crisis began months ago with the military coup that ousted the nation's first freely elected leader after weeks of protests against him. President Mohamed Morsi was seen by many Egyptians as increasingly authoritarian. Then it was the turn of Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood supporters to take to the streets. But the Egyptian army turned its guns on them and killed hundreds, maybe thousands. Then the chemical attack in Syria happened, and it seemed like the world forgot about Egypt. That is, except for reporters like David Kirkpatrick, Cairo bureau chief of the New York Times. So, David, if you would bring us up to speed, you've been writing as though there are now two Egypts, the major urban centers like Cairo, which we've heard a lot about, and then the countryside where you just were.
Well, what's frustrating is that there is only one Egyptian media, and it thoroughly loves the current military-appointed government. So it's very hard to get an accurate picture of what life is like outside of Cairo. So I went as far as Minya, a city up the river, about 3 or 4 hours, and I found really surprisingly strong support for President Morsi there.
Do you get the feeling that the protests there might get violent?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. You know, suppose you lived in a country where you felt that the military had ousted your elected president. You know, would you join the resistance? Would you find that it was a prudent thing to do to take up arms against this new government that had squashed the democratic process? You know, that had already happened here under President Mubarak in the 1980s and 1990s, that there was an armed Islamist insurgency. So we're all waiting to see whether that might happen again. You know, there was a car bomb that went off in Cairo on Thursday, September 5th, in an effort to assassinate the interior minister. And that was, for many people, a kind of a warning sign. You know, the minister himself said at the time, having survived the attack, this is just the beginning.
Now, you just used the word insurgency. That suggests some kind of, military action against the government. Is that what we're seeing now in Egypt?
Well, I wouldn't, the word insurgency might be a little grand. We're certainly seeing sporadic violence against the government, and there are fears that it could turn into an insurgency. You know, there are, especially in the Sinai, there's a pretty steady trickle of violence against police and soldiers. A few of them are killed every day or every few days. The Sinai has always been an area where the reach of the central government was weak to begin with. So that's sort of its own thing. What was striking about this car bomb on September 5th, the effort to assassinate the interior minister, is that it went off in a crowded Cairo street. So it showed really a pretty casual willingness to incur civilian deaths and casualties, as well as the ability to perpetrate this kind of a pretty major bombing inside the capital.
You know, it struck me that the military ruler now who deposed President Morsi has done very little to try and placate the opposition. They're a huge part of the Egyptian population. Morsi was elected by them, and yet Muslim Brotherhood folks are being rounded up. A spokesman was just put in jail yesterday. It's awfully curious.
Yeah, how's that going to work, you really wonder? They're planning to go to the polls with a referendum on a new constitution in just a few months and then have parliamentary elections after that. And they're still talking about free, open, credible, democratic elections with international monitors. And yet, at the same time, their actions suggest that they're planning to systematically exclude what had been the largest political current in the country. And I don't honestly know how that's going to play out. Certainly, the writing on the wall seems to suggest that they have no intention whatsoever of allowing Islamist political parties to participate fully in the democratic process.
David Kirkpatrick, Cairo Bureau Chief of The New York Times. Thanks for your time.
Always good to talk to you.
At the International Criminal Court in The Hague today, a judge issued this warning. Any revelation of the identity of a witness whose identity has been protected amounts to an offense. This came during the trial of Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto for crimes against humanity. Kenyan media named the very first witness in the trial. She testified yesterday. Ruto and his boss, President Uhuru Kenyatta, deny orchestrating violence that followed disputed elections 6 years ago. More than 1,000 people were killed. It's the first time in the history of the court that serving leaders have been called to account for their actions. And so the case is seen as a huge test for the concept of international justice. The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse has been to Eldoret in the Rift Valley. That's Ruto's hometown and the scene of some of the worst violence.
Well, you can still see the scars from those clashes nearly 6 years ago now in the village of Kiamba outside Eldoret. Burnt out houses, their roofs caved in. But the people who fled from here back then have now returned and they're living in the ruins of their former homes.
We ran into the church. There were so many of us. We were all packed in.
That's Purity Musina. She turned 17 this summer, so she must have been 11 years old at the time. And as she tells her story, she keeps her eyes fixed firmly on the ground and she's constantly wringing her hands.
And then all hell broke loose. People came screaming.
It was the 1st of January 2008. Kenya was about to descend into a four-month-long nightmare of killing and brutality. Along with hundreds of others, Purity and her mother had taken shelter in the church in the hope that it would provide them with protection. It didn't. The attackers from a rival ethnic group set the building on fire. Those who couldn't get out burnt to death. Others were set upon as they fled.
I remember at the gate, I saw a woman carrying a small child. The attackers snatched the boy from her arms. Then they slashed him with a machete. They chopped his feet off. I watched him die.
The International Criminal Court will have to decide whether William Ruto, now Kenya's deputy president, was instrumental in orchestrating this and other acts of violence. The president, Uhuru Kenyatta, will defend himself against similar charges in November. It's a legal drama, and the nation is hooked. Well, we've come now to a small eatery cafe attached to a butcher's shop in the centre of Eldoret, where people have come to watch the trial live.
I don't think it will bring justice. We pray that this thing should come to an end, because we need our leaders to come back and continue with their job, and they are innocent.
That's Kiplagat Komen, a local businessman who reflects a pervading sense of suspicion of the ICC here in what is William Ruto's heartland. In recent weeks, several witnesses for the prosecution have withdrawn their testimony. The prosecution says they've been threatened and paid off.
These people might have been bribed to speak the ill of the people.
Elections in Kenya are deeply rooted in ethnic politics. 5 years ago here in Eldoret, clashes broke out essentially because one ethnic group, the Kalenjin, felt that their leader had been cheated out of victory by another ethnic group, the Kikuyu. But since then, these two blocs have gone into coalition and they fought the last election on a unified platform. And that, say some, is proof that reconciliation is working here.
Those are marriages of convenience. Reconciliation process has not actually begun.
That's Major John Say, retired from the military, now paramount leader of the Council of Kalenjin Elders. He says his community could react badly if Mr. Ruto is convicted.
If Ruto is found guilty, God forbid, then the entire community will feel convicted and guilty. And so I do not know what will happen.
The Kenyan cases have put the International Criminal Court under intense scrutiny. It's attracted criticism from across the continent for pursuing almost exclusively African cases. Meanwhile, many of those who bore the brunt of the violence 5 years ago feel they have little to gain from the judicial process going on at The Hague. Purity Musina.
Those who burned our houses are not the ones who sell us our milk and our vegetables. We have forgiven each other. We have put it behind us.
But defenders of international justice insist that if no one is held accountable this time, history will be bound to repeat itself.
The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse reporting from Eldoret, Kenya. A more common complaint about politicians the world over is that they pander a lot. To get elected, it seems, you have to tell the people what they want to hear, not what they have to hear. But that may not be true at the public high school in South Africa that we're following this year. It's called the Center of Science and Technology, and this week it held student council elections. The world's Anders Kelto explains.
At 8 in the morning, the student body filed into the school auditorium. On stage, 19 students in matching blue sweaters shifted nervously. Each was about to explain, in just 1 minute, why he or she should be elected to student council. I asked the school's principal, Fadila Cooper, what to expect. Would this feel like a political contest?
It would be more of a popularity contest.
A popularity contest with students trying to win votes through charm or humor, she said. At first, it looked like Mrs. Cooper was right. Vuyo Kazi, a junior with black glasses, stepped forward on stage. She unfolded a piece of paper with writing on both sides. It looked like she was about to deliver a State of the Union address. Then, after a dramatic pause, she said,
Don't waste your time.
Just vote for me. That got plenty of laughs. But then, a broad-shouldered junior named Luando stepped up.
We all know that our school has experienced some drastic changes in terms of behavior. Bad behavior has somehow managed to make its way into our school.
He mentioned bad behaviors such as vandalism and students cutting class. He said these were common problems, and as a leader, he would try to correct them, though in his one-minute speech, he didn't say how. Next, a tall girl named Sipo Kazi spoke.
I feel that you guys should vote for me because of the issues of late coming and the behavior of us learners towards our teachers.
She said classmates were disrespecting teachers and violating the school's dress code. There were more speeches like this, candidates criticizing student behavior. I couldn't help but wonder, how would this go over? Would these candidates be seen like Jimmy Carter, forever criticized for scolding the American people? After the speeches ended and the votes were cast, I spoke to Laratu, a sophomore. She said she voted for a candidate because he acknowledged the hard truth, that students are acting out of line.
Behavior is really a problem in our school. So I actually like the fact that he was focused on their behavior.
Other students said similar things. They wanted leaders who would hold students accountable. And I asked Mrs. Cooper, the principal, what she thought of the speeches.
Well, I think some of them were very good, and I'm glad that my initial reservations weren't substantiated.
The elections did not appear to be a popularity contest. Mrs. Cooper said the event left her feeling hopeful that students, not just teachers, could help improve the school. Election results will be announced next month. For The World, I'm Anders Kelto in Cape Town.
You're listening to The World on PRI. I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World. Russian President Vladimir Putin sure does like his hogs. We're talking about motorcycles. And when he dons his leather jacket and goes for a ride these days, he is usually flanked by a motorcycle gang known as the Night Wolves. Simon Schuster is the Russia correspondent for Time magazine. He writes about Putin and the Night Wolves in the current issue.
The Night Wolves are your pretty standard motorcycle gang with the leather, chains, beards, tattoos, Harley Davidsons, and so on. But they stand out somewhat for their very vocal espousal of Russian patriotism, Slavic pride, and a great respect for the Russian Orthodox Church. Now, all of those values Vladimir Putin has certainly highlighted in his rhetoric since he took a third term as president last May. So that made them natural allies in a way. Putin has started attending their rallies and their motorcycle rides regularly. His preferred vehicle is a three-wheeler, I guess, for the sake of safety. Also a Harley Davidson, and he likes to ride at the front of their columns and speak at their patriotic rallies that they hold.
The Night Wolves have a reputation, from what I understand, very similar to the Hells Angels in the United States, sort of badasses slash hoodlums. How did they become kind of a mainstream political force?
There are a couple of factors at play. Vladimir Putin is very fond of various macho stunts, be it, you know, shirtless horseback riding or harpooning whales. And this plays into that kind of macho image that he tries to project. But I think more ideologically, their espoused, at least, ideology of Slavic unity really jibes with his idea of uniting the former Soviet Union into a new Eurasian Union, an economic free trade zone, and a military bloc with Moscow, of course, at the center.
Where do the Night Wolves fit into that?
The Night Wolves, interestingly, fit into a kind of Kremlin soft power in that they have chapters really across the Slavic world, Macedonia, Serbia, Ukraine, various Baltic countries, and they hold rallies in these countries to promote the use of the Russian language, which many of these countries have abandoned since the fall of the Soviet Union, and to really reconnect Russian culture with its former Soviet satellite states.
Now, you mentioned Vladimir Putin rides a three-wheel Harley. What does this say about Russia today if their version of Hell's Angels have to ride American motorcycles?
Yeah, it's a good question and another running joke. In Russia, Russian cars are, well, pretty crappy. Even Russians are first
still?
To admit that. I got to say, yeah, still. My grandfather has one here in the suburbs of Moscow just because he's a model patriot. But mostly people strive to have foreign cars, you know, and that says something about Russia's industrial prowess, that the heights of engineering and science and technology that the Soviet Union did pull off. I mean, remember the Sputnik satellite, remember the first man launched into space was a Soviet. And those kinds of achievements that really get the attention and the respect of the international community have not been achieved under Putin or really after the fall of the Soviet Union.
So, Simon, what is the preferred bike of the Night Wolves?
Certainly the Harley-Davidson. I mean, they talk a good game about the United States being an aggressor trying to take over all of the countries of the world and being Russia's geopolitical foe, but they sure do love that Harley-Davidson.
Simon Schuster from Time Magazine, thank you.
Thank you.
An accent can be both a burden and an opportunity. Some immigrant actors spend years and thousands of dollars trying to lose their accent, but these days many are finding that their accent can actually help them land roles. Sara Loscos is a Spanish reporter in New York. She moved there from Barcelona 3 years ago, and she knows the pros and cons of having an accent.
I'm a journalist, but I'm also an actress. And as you can hear, I have an accent. On my first day of acting school in Manhattan, as soon as I opened my mouth to say good morning, a nice academic advisor enrolled me in an accent reduction course. And there, I met a lot of foreign actors like me.
The moment you walk in the audition room, you see the faces when you have an accent. You see how they look at you.
One of the first friends I met was Nanda Abella. She is from Argentina. She eventually hired a private teacher to help her with her accent.
We don't know what to do.
We don't know what to do.
We don't know what to do.
Yeah, don't. It's very short.
Don't.
We don't know what to do.
We don't know what to do.
Yeah, that's gorgeous.
Every other week, she pays $90 for 45 minutes with an accent coach who helps her sound more American.
This is for you.
This is for you.
For. Like fur coat?
Yeah.
Same
fur.
This is for you.
This is for you.
One thing is clear to Nanda. The combination of being a Latina and having an accent limits the kinds of roles she gets.
I did a maid one time. Then I did another one who was kind of a maid assistant. And then I was also a dance professor by like Latin rhythms. And this Latina working in a tattoo parlor. all of them, it was like a Latina doing something. And I don't mind being a Latina doing something. I mind when it's like a Latina in positions that denote some prejudice against the Latina population. That's what I don't like, you know. I want to be the Latina lawyer, you know, the Latina professional. I don't want to be, you know, the Latina maid all the time. It's not that I have something against maids. It's just that I feel that that's prejudiced. Mm-hmm. Because you're a Latina, you can't be a successful businesswoman. Mm-hmm. Oh, come on.
And for Latinas who don't look Latina, it can be even harder.
I remember this Mexican girl. She looked like a German girl. She was like super white, super like German. And the poor thing, she wouldn't get anything because she couldn't go to Caucasian roles because she had an accent and it was a Spanish accent, but she could not go for Latina.
But things are starting to change. Big stars like Sofia Vergara and Penelope Cruz are slowly training the ears of mainstream American audiences to accept thick accents, like mine.
There is a chest with jewels, jewels with the power to rule the wind and tide.
You're making that up.
Wait. I am with child. Yours.
The fact that Penelope Cruz can do like super productions and can be leading role, yeah, that shows you that people are more open to hear that those accents. I don't know, things are opening more and more.
Ruya Koman sees it that way too. She's an actress from Turkey, but last year she got a role as a Latina in a play in New York. The director saw her headshot and assumed she was Colombian or Venezuelan, so she had to learn to speak with a Spanish accent.
And then I was listening to, like, Sofia Vergara for, like, days.
I know that I have an accent, but people understand me just fine.
And I tried to imitate. So, but in the end, like, there wasn't really enough time to do it, so I apparently sounded very Russian.
Rui is still working on it.
I really see a lot of casting notices where they need, you know, Hispanic actresses. So I think it's, like, a huge market of things you can do.
It's not just a growing market for actors. There's also more opportunities for Spanish-speaking reporters. That's good news for me. But once again, the accent comes into play. I have a Castilian accent, so even my Spanish sounds different from the Spanish we usually hear in the U.S. I guess I'll always have an accent, no matter what language I speak. For The World, I'm Sara Loscos in New York.
Sara Loscos comes to us from Feet in Two Worlds, a project of the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School. You can see photos of her at work on her accent at theworld.org. I'm Aaron Schachter. Forget Hello Kitty. In Egypt, it's all about SpongeBob. Ahead, an American who's trying to document Egypt's fascination with the talking cartoon sponge.
The best and most insidious part of this project is that people don't tend to notice SpongeBob everywhere until you mention it to them, and then you really do start to notice him everywhere.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating 25 new global heroes, runners who didn't let a diagnosis of chronic disease end their run at the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon this October 6th. More at Medtronic.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. When a massive earthquake hit Haiti in 2010, the U.S. waived visa requirements for orphaned Haitian children. More than 1,000 flew to the U.S. to be adopted by new moms and dads, but many Haitian children had biological parents living and working in the U.S., and more than 3 years after the earthquake, those parents are still struggling to bring their children here. Reporter Amy Bracken has the story.
Carmine Pierre sits on the couch in her bare one bedroom she shares with her sister outside Boston. She's scratching away at a prepaid phone card. Pierre burns through these things, calling her 11-year-old son Marc Kelly in Haiti. She hasn't seen him since he was four.
Hello?
Pierre got a chance to come to the States in 2007 when her father was granted asylum. So she left Marc Kelly in the care of her aunt in Haiti while she worked to get residency and make some money in the U.S. The idea was to bring her son here. It became even more urgent after the earthquake in 2010. She says her aunt was in the kitchen with Mark Kelly when the earthquake struck. Her aunt pushed him outside and saved his life, but she died along with her son. Pierre says her uncle survived, but he's still in shock. My child is alone, she says. He's not in good hands. Mark Kelly is among more than 100,000 Haitians who've been approved for family-based visas to come to the U.S., yet are still waiting for the necessary documents. The children of green card holders, like Mark Kelly, wait on average about 3 years. For many other family members, it can take 12. It's not supposed to be like this, says Stephen Forrester. He's with the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, and he's been campaigning for a remedy since the quake.
10 days after the earthquake, an op-ed appeared in the Washington Post by Elliot Abrams of the Reagan and Bush administration, basically saying, look, if you want to help Haiti recover, one very effective way is to increase legal immigration.
One argument was that it would boost remittances from the U.S. to Haiti.
So a number of major newspaper editorial boards started advocating that a Haitian family reunification program be created for those people who our government has already approved to join their families here.
Over the past 3 years, letters and petitions have poured into the White House and the Department of Homeland Security in favor of such a program. Part of the appeal, says Forrester, is simplicity. It wouldn't require an act of Congress, just executive approval. Forrester knows this because it's already been done for Cubans back in 2007 under George W. Bush. President Obama renewed the policy for Cubans in 2010, after the earthquake in Haiti. It's a sore point for Haitians, especially in South Florida. Many complain about the double standard when it comes to Cuba.
It is really, really frustrating. After over 30 years, we are still fighting for the same thing.
Marlene Bastien heads a social services organization called FEM, or Haitian Women in Miami. She feels let down by the Obama administration.
It is time for President Obama to create a Haitian family reunification parole, just like a Cuban family reunification parole has been created. When you compare Cuba and Haiti right now, Haiti is in 10 times worse state than Cuba.
The administration hasn't come out against a Haitian family reunification program. No one at Homeland Security would speak to me about the issue. But some Haiti activists say people close to the president assured them it was on the agenda, just on hold, first while Obamacare was being debated, and now with immigration reform unresolved. But many Haitians say the immigration bill doesn't address their immediate concerns. Carmine Pierre's immediate concern is that her son is spending his childhood in an unstable household. In her air-conditioned apartment, she smiles when she talks about the phone calls they share. She tells me, he said, Ma, I'm getting big now. When are you going to come get me? I ask her what she said. I told him, I don't know, she says. And then she stops laughing. Jesus, I don't know. For The World, I'm Amy Bracken, Boston.
Amy Bracken is an immigration journalism fellow with the French American Foundation. It's bull versus man for our geo quiz today. Actually, it's more like bull versus a whole bunch of men. That's a tradition in the town we want you to name. It's in Spain, and every year there's a festival there called Toro de la Vega. It involves a bull chased by many men, some on horseback, others on foot, all armed with spears. And yes, the animal is eventually speared to death. Animal rights activists want to stop the practice, but the townspeople are determined to keep their tradition going. So which town in Spain is famous for its Toro de la Vega festival? Here's an extra clue. The town gave its name to the treaty signed by Spain and Portugal in 1494. It drew a line that divided the world for colonization purposes into Spanish and Portuguese halves. That line helped create the modern map of South America. Got it? The answer's coming up in a bit. Our next story is about a topic that's as controversial in Mexico as it is here, abortion. First trimester abortions were decriminalized in Mexico City about 6 years ago. In response, anti-abortion activists launched a counteroffensive across the rest of the country. Since then, half of Mexico states have passed new constitutional amendments banning abortion. Catherine Joyce is the author of The Child Catchers, Rescue, Trafficking, and the New Gospel of Adoption. She traveled to Mexico City to examine the abortion debate there, and she found activists heavily influenced by strategies used here north of the border.
There's a real sense of a culture war that is shaping up. There is Mexico's own so-called Rosary Belt, where there is a lot of activism against comprehensive sex ed in schools, promotion of condoms for youth, and also, notably, what I looked at the most was the wholesale export of the crisis pregnancy center model from the U.S. to Mexico, where there are now 40 CPCs, crisis pregnancy centers, that have sprung up in recent years.
Now, those CPCs, crisis pregnancy centers, are a place where a woman can get a free pregnancy test. Some of these women who go to these centers would think they're learning about options, including abortion, but instead they're counseled to continue the pregnancy. And that's what we're talking about, cropping up in Mexico City. How prominent are these centers? And explain a little bit how they work.
Sure. In the U.S., the CPCs have been around for decades, and a lot of times they're advertised in a vague way. If you're pregnant, we can help, or just the offers of free pregnancy tests, like you mentioned. And then when women come in, often instead what they encounter is a hard sell against abortion. Oftentimes they are made to watch graphic anti-abortion videos. At times, in some CPCs, there has been a lot of anecdotal evidence that crisis pregnancy centers are giving women medical misinformation about the results of having an abortion, telling them that abortion will lead to breast cancer, to severe depression, or worse. So there has been a history of questionable practices associated with the CPCs here in the U.S. And in Mexico, we're seeing some of the same things. Women go in and they are being shown, in some cases, exactly the same video. They are being shown a subtitled version of The Silent Scream. They are being given literature that's in Spanish, but has been printed here in the U.S. One of the pamphlets I found was printed in Cincinnati, Ohio. And in some cases, you know, they are being given the same sorts of medical misinformation, threatening them that if they go forward with an abortion, they are going to end up with suicidal depression or cancer or worse.
And did you find that it's the same groups from America who are now in Mexico City?
In some cases, it is. When I was reporting there, I worked with a translator who went into one of these crisis pregnancy centers herself, and we found that crisis pregnancy center listed on the website of Heartbeat International, which is a network of crisis pregnancy centers that was started here in the United States. They represent about 1,000 networked CPCs here and about 1,800 worldwide, including many of the ones in Mexico.
And there's a sort of tragic comic story, I guess, about your translator, Katya, when she went into that center.
Absolutely. One of the things that happens in Mexico that doesn't tend to happen as much in the U.S. is that women are actually, on a routine basis, getting false diagnoses of either how far along they are in pregnancy, or in some cases, being falsely told that they are pregnant when they are not. That is what happened to my translator. I think a little more common is for women who are early on in pregnancy to be being shown ultrasound images of pregnancies that are far more developed than they could possibly be carrying. But there is just kind of a startling amount of misinformation that's being given out through these CPCs.
Hmm. Now, Mexico City, right, is the only place in the country that allows abortions. That happened 6 years ago. Is the idea catching on anywhere else? When places outside Mexico City look at this debate, how does it resonate?
In Mexico, I think the fight is still pretty fierce. In fact, a lot of women have actually been arrested and some have been jailed for having abortions in states where it is not legal. Across the region in Latin America, there has started to be a little bit of movement. In the past year, I think a lot of people were paying attention to a case in El Salvador where a woman, Beatrice, was denied a life-saving abortion for many months before the government finally relented and allowed her to have a C-section delivery. But the only other country that has passed a new abortion rights law in the recent years is Uruguay. There's been a lot of pushback, including from U.S. conservatives who have been consulting with anti-abortion groups there in the country. But so far, they seem to be sticking with it.
Investigative journalist Catherine Joyce, her new piece in The Nation magazine is called Mexico's Abortion Wars, American Style. It was reported in partnership with the Investigative Fund of The Nation Institute. Catherine, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Back to Spain now, where bullfighting has dropped in popularity in recent years. Attendance is way down, and more people consider it a cruel practice. But there's another bull tradition that animal rights activists say is much crueler and still thriving. It's a festival in the central Spanish town of Tordesillas. That's the answer to our geo quiz today. The World's Jerry Haddon was in Tordesillas for this year's festival.
It seems the entire town of Tordesillas comes out to witness this medieval tradition. Parents with kids, young men dressed in white and red, carrying long, steel-tipped spears, and older folks like Angela San Pedro. She says El Toro de la Vega, or the Bull from the Valley, began some 500 years ago when a mad Spanish queen was imprisoned in the church tower. They locked her away up there, she says, but the queen said, I want a bull. I want to see it down below in the valley. And she got her way. She was able to watch the spectacle from the top of the tower. That spectacle doesn't involve the usual lone bullfighter armed with nothing but a crimson cape.
No, no, son gente a pie. Gente a pie. Van con unas lanzas.
No, San Pedro says, it's a bunch of guys with spears, some on foot, some on horses. You need a lot of courage. This is our tradition, and they want to end it, she says. The people who are against us. But this belongs to the town. Every town has its traditions. They just don't involve chasing down a lone bull, say animal rights activists, then stabbing it to death with lances. About 250 activists face off against police and townsfolk before the spectacle begins, chanting, more culture, less torture.
Que ningún ser vivo tiene por qué sufrir una tortura.
One activist named Carmen says no living creature deserves to be tortured. All creatures feel pain. People need to realize, to open their hearts. Soon the bull, a huge brown beast with exceptionally long horns, goes tearing past along a cordoned-off road and out into the pasture. Assassins, shout the activists. They sprint across neighboring farmland, hoping to disrupt the event before it's too late. But the ritual is underway. Hundreds of men circle the bull. They charge and stab the animal with their long spears. And then the bull reminds you how dangerous it is. A photographer gets too close, the bull charges, knocks him to the ground, and gores him in the thigh.
Mira, ya está la ambulancia.
Amid all the shouting, one man takes advantage of the bull's distraction and plunges a spear into its chest. This is the fatal blow. He's led away by cheering companions. The animal rights folks are crestfallen and furious. And this is when today's real confrontation begins. The one between two cultures, two worldviews, modernity versus tradition. It's one of those moments when you realize how divided Spain is. It ends with both sides hurling insults and townsfolk tossing stones. One activist gets hit in the head and needs stitches. Another activist, who won't give her name, says they failed to save the bull, but they never expected to. She says our intention was to get the word out, to reach other Spaniards who don't realize what's going on. They hope all the attention pressures Tordesillas to end the bull kill once and for all. Two regions of Spain have already banned traditional bullfighting. But spectator Maria José Casquedo says she doubts that day is coming anytime soon to Tordesillas. If you don't like soccer, she says, you should respect those who do. We deserve the same. Those activists may think the bull of the valley's days are numbered, but I hope those of us who love bullfighting will fight to the end to defend our tradition, she says, waving her hand in a stabbing motion. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Tordesillas, Spain.
You're listening to The World on PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Aaron Schachter. This is The World. McDonald's is a global fast food giant with 33,000 restaurants in 118 countries. But folks in the town of Tacoma, Australia, are dead set against a new franchise there. They formed a group called Burger Off to protest against it, but the group failed to stop construction from starting this year, so it decided to take its protest all the way to Chicago, to McDonald's headquarters. Burger Off representative Gary Muratori was there today to deliver a petition.
When we handed the petition of 95,000 names across today, it was like we were handing them a hot potato. They had a guy there from corporate responsibility. He wouldn't touch it. He handed it off to a security guard who nearly got a hernia carrying it. It's something like 7,000 pages.
You know, Australians are known as a pretty happy-go-lucky, live-and-let-live sort of folk. What is your main beef, if you'll pardon the pun, with McDonald's?
Well, I guess it's a case of we don't like bullies in Australia. When it was proposed that this was going to happen to our community, the council knew it would be contentious and they asked for people to put submissions in. I think the council expected to maybe get 20 or 30 submissions. They got 1,170. And the council did the right thing. They listened and they voted it down 9-0. McDonald's went ahead to a regional planning tribunal and they had it turned over. They spent about $1 million on this.
What's wrong with McDonald's?
Well, there's nothing wrong with McDonald's. We're not anti-McDonald's per se. There's one just down the road. It's less than 3 miles. You can basically get there in a car in 7 minutes. The franchisee that runs that has been up and told us that he's happy to support the people because, you know, he's got a store there and he wants to run it. And the protest is hurting his store. And we say, you know, where your store is, it's in an appropriate location. Tacoma's not an appropriate location. This will be the closest store to a national park anywhere in Australia. It's right opposite a preschool. It's right opposite a elementary school. It's too close to elderly residents who are concerned about crime because the strip of shops at the moment closes at 8 p.m. every night. McDonald's want to run this 24/7, and it's 5 or 6 times bigger than the nearest shop in the strip. So, you know, they want to come in and be large and in charge, and we won't let them.
Gary, I wonder how big a town Tacoma is.
It's just under 2,000 people.
Ah, so it's a really teeny tiny place.
Yeah, it's a little town. That's what I say. It just doesn't make sense to put a McDonald's there. They keep on saying it's for the betterment of the community, but we know that they're going after the tourist dollar because of the forest. People come up there to, you know, do forest walks, to look at lyrebirds, kookaburras, platypuses in the local creek. So people come up here not to see an homogenous fast food change. They come up for the forest.
You have 2,000 people in Tacoma and 95,000 signatures. Is that right? Where do those come from?
That's right. They're all around Australia. People have seen that this is a David versus Goliath battle. We've been putting out the media message that if it happens in our town, it could happen in your town. And what's to stop them doing it somewhere up on the Great Barrier Reef where there's pristine rainforests? What's to stop them doing it at Ayers Rock? And I say to the American audience, what would happen if they did it at Mount Rushmore? There would be an outcry.
Gary Muratori is a representative for the group Burger Off, a group of Australians protesting today in Chicago against McDonald's moving into their town, Tacoma, Australia. Gary, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Gotta love that accent. We asked McDonald's for a response and got a statement that says the company respects the protesters' right to peacefully express their views. It adds, quote, McDonald's Australia has followed due process every step of the way to build a family restaurant on a highway that already houses a number of food and service outlets. The only legal action that has been brought to protect those with opposing views from putting themselves and others in danger through illegal and dangerous actions, end quote. You can read the whole statement at theworld.org. Back to Egypt now, where we began today's program. Earlier, we heard about the growing political divide among Egyptians. Now we shift to a much lighter topic, cartoons. Now, from my time living and working in the Middle East, I can attest to the strange popularity of cartoon characters in that part of the world. Hello Kitty comes to mind, and Tom and Jerry, believe it or not, are also popular. But SpongeBob SquarePants? The world's Clark Boyd explains.
Sickly fascinating. That's how my own kid recently described an episode of SpongeBob. It is, after all, about a giant talking yellow sponge that lives in a pineapple at the bottom of the ocean. The thing is, I always wondered if SpongeBob traveled well, culturally speaking. He and his aquatic buddies have been translated into many languages, including, says YouTube, Arabic. Sickly fascinating in any language, obviously. But here's something I wasn't prepared for, a Tumblr blog called SpongeBob on the Nile.
The best and most insidious part of this project is that people don't tend to notice SpongeBob everywhere until you mention it to them, and then you really do start to notice him everywhere.
Elizabeth Jaquette is currently a grad student at Columbia University, but she spent the better part of the past 6 years living and working in Cairo as a teacher. Jaquette tells me her own SpongeBob awakening happened about a year after the January 2011 revolution.
So you're walking through Tahrir Square, and, you know, after the revolution, after the first 18 days of the revolution, there were all sorts of street vendors that had set up shops, so selling tea and sweet potatoes and trinkets, and everything had an Egyptian flag. And when I came back in 2012, all of them were suddenly half SpongeBob. So the first picture I took was of SpongeBob making his way into Tahrir Square.
Jaquette says she was soon seeing SpongeBob, well, everywhere.
On T-shirts, on cupcakes, on balloons, on masks that vendors sell on the street. I think one of my personal favorites is a SpongeBob tissue box cover, which was rather cute, absorbent on both levels there.
And so Jaquette and a friend decided to document SpongeBob's rise in Egypt by starting a blog. Scroll through the pictures and you'll be amazed. There's SpongeBob at the beach. There he is in a taxi. Yep, there he is on a hijab. And oh, there he is in scarily accurate form made out of pita bread, kebab, and vegetable chunks. And even though Jaquette is back in the U.S. now, the blog is still going strong. People from Egypt and throughout the Middle East keep submitting photos.
I think my favorite has got to be Maggie Fick, who's a reporter for Reuters, took a brilliant photo of SpongeBob in Martyr Square in Libya, and she was there covering the anniversary of the revolution, and people are celebrating. There's a woman waving a Libyan flag, and next to her is a life-size SpongeBob mascot.
Jaquette says the blog has documentary evidence of a similar mascot in Syria. Now, my instinct here is to push, to dig deep, to find out why SpongeBob is suddenly appearing so frequently across a region so filled with revolution, war, and chaos. Jaquette tells me, resist the urge to ask why.
You know, I think if I could answer that question, we wouldn't be running this Tumblr. Certainly, there's many theories behind SpongeBob's emergence in Egypt, and not just Egypt, but the region at large. But I think here, the question is really more compelling than the answer. I think if we knew the answer, we would stop taking pictures. Why is he so popular? Nobody's come up with a good enough theory for any of us, so we'll keep on taking the pictures.
Or, in the case of Egyptian pop star Hamada Hilal, singing about him. Great. Now I won't be able to get that out of my head. And you won't either. For The World, this is Clark Boyd.
Sampling of SpongeBob on the Nile's finer photographic moments at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Aaron Schachter. Thanks for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org. The Rita Allen Foundation, investing in transformative ideas in their earliest stages to leverage their growth and promote breakthrough solutions to significant problems. Online at ritaallen.org. And by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.